and by the end of the century in Britain, they had acceded to laws banning vivisection. The campaign to protect animals lost momentum during the middle decades of the 20th century. The austerity from the two world wars had created a meat hunger, and the populace was so grateful for the flood of cheap meat from factory farming that it gave little thought to where the meat came from. Also, beginning in the 19-teens, behaviorism took over psychology and philosophy and decreed that the very idea of animal experience was a form of unscientific naivete, the cardinal sin of anthropomorphism. Around the same time, the animal welfare movement, like the pacifist movements of the 19th century, developed an image problem and became associated with do-gooders and health food nuts. Even one of the greatest moral voices of the 20th century, George Orwell, was contemptuous of vegetarians. One sometimes gets the impression that the mere words socialism and communism draw towards them with magnetic force every fruit juice drinker, nudist, sandal wearer, sex maniac, Quaker, nature cure quack, pacifist and feminist in England. The food crank is by definition a person willing to cut himself off from human society in hopes of adding 5 years onto the life of his carcass, that is, a person out of touch with common humanity. All this changed in the 1970s. The plight of livestock and factory farms was brought to light in Britain in a 1964 book by Ruth Harrison called Animal Machines. Other public figures soon took up the cause. Bridget Brophy has been credited with the term animal rights, which she deliberately coined by analogy. She wanted to associate the case for non-human animals with that clutch of egalitarian or libertarian ideas which have sporadically, though quite often with impressively actual political results, come to the rescue of other oppressed classes, such as slaves or homosexuals or women. The real turning point was the philosopher Peter Singer's 1975 book, Animal Liberation, the so-called Bible of the Animal Rights Movement. The sobriquet is doubly ironic because Singer is a secularist and a utilitarian, and utilitarians have been skeptical of natural rights ever since Bentham called the idea nonsense on stilts. But following Bentham, Singer laid out a razor-sharp argument for a full consideration of the interests of animals, while not necessarily granting them rights. The argument begins with the realization that it is a consciousness rather than intelligence or species membership that makes a being worthy of moral consideration. It follows that we should not inflict avoidable pain on animals any more than we should inflict it on young children or the mentally handicapped. And a corollary is that we should all be vegetarians. Humans can thrive on a modern vegetarian diet, and animals' interests in a life free of pain and premature death surely outweigh the marginal increase in pleasure we get from eating their flesh. The fact that humans naturally eat meat, whether by cultural tradition, biological evolution, or both, is morally irrelevant. Like Brophy, Singer made every effort to analogize the animal welfare movement to the other rights revolutions of the 1960s and 1970s. The analogy began with his title, an allusion to colonial liberation, women's liberation, and gay liberation, and it continued with his popularization of the term speciesism, a sibling of racism and sexism. Singer quoted an 18th-century critic of the feminist writer Mary Wollstonecraft, who argued that if she was right about women, we would also have to grant rights to brutes. The critic had intended it as a reducto ad absurdum, but Singer argued that it was a sound deduction. For Singer, these analogies are far more than rhetorical techniques. In another book, The Expanding Circle, he advanced a theory of moral progress in which human beings were endowed by natural selection with a kernel of empathy toward kin and allies, and have gradually extended it to wider and wider circles of living things, from family and village to clan, tribe, nation, species, and all of sentient life. This book owes much to this insight. Singer's moral arguments were not the only forces that made people sympathetic to animals. In the 1970s, it was a good thing to be a socialist, fruit juice drinker, nudist, sandal wearer, sex maniac, Quaker, nature cure quack, pacifist and feminist, sometimes all at the same time. The compassion-based argument for vegetarianism was soon fortified with other arguments, that meat was fattening, toxic, and artery hardening, that growing crops to feed animals rather than people was a waste of land and food, and that the effluvia of farm animals was a major pollutant, particularly methane, the greenhouse gas that comes out of both ends of a cow. Whether you call it animal liberation, animal rights, animal welfare, or the animal movement, the decades since 1975 in Western culture have seen a growing intolerance of violence toward animals. Changes are visible in at least half a dozen ways. I've already mentioned the first, the protection of animals in laboratories. Not only are live animals now protected from being hurt, stressed, or killed in the conduct of science, but in high school biology labs, the venerable custom of dissecting pickled frogs has gone the way of inkwells and slide rules. In some schools, it has been replaced by V-Frog, a virtual reality dissection program. And in commercial laboratories, the routine use of animals to test cosmetics and household products has come under fire. Since the 1940s, following reports of women being blinded by mascara containing coal tar, many household products have been tested for safety with the infamous Dreyer's procedure, which applies a compound to the eyes of rabbits and looks for signs of damage. Until the 1980s, few people had heard of the Dreyer's test, and until the 1990s, few would have recognized the term cruelty-free, the designation for products that avoid it. Today, the term is emblazoned on thousands of consumer goods and has become familiar enough that the label cruelty-free condoms does not raise an eyebrow. Animal testing in consumer product labs continues, but has been increasingly regulated and reduced. Another conspicuous change is the outlawing of blood sports. I've already mentioned that since 2005, the British aristocracy has had to retire its bugles and bloodhounds, and in 2008, Louisiana became the last American state to ban cockfights, a sport that had been popular throughout the world for centuries. Like many prohibited vices, the practice continues, particularly among immigrants from Latin America and Southeast Asia, but it has long been in decline in the United States and has been outlawed in many other countries as well. Even the proud bullfight has been threatened. In 2004, the city of Barcelona outlawed the deadly contests between matador and beast, and in 2010, the ban was extended to the entire region of Catalonia. The state-run Spanish television network had already ended live coverage of bullfights because they were deemed too violent for children. The European Parliament has considered a continent-wide ban as well. Like formal dueling and other violent customs sanctified by pomp and ceremony, bullfighting may eventually bite the dust, not because the compassion condemns it or governments outlaw it, but because detraction will not suffer it. In his 1932 book, Death in the Afternoon, Ernest Hemingway explained the primal appeal of the bullfight. The matador must have a spiritual enjoyment of the moment of killing, killing cleanly and in a way which gives you aesthetic pleasure and pride, has always been one of the greatest enjoyments of a part of the human race. Once you accept the rule of death, thou shalt not kill is an easily and naturally obeyed commandment. But when a man is still in rebellion against death, he has pleasure in taking to himself one of the godlike attributes, that of giving it. This is one of the most profound feelings in those men who enjoy killing. These things are done in pride, and pride, of course, is a Christian sin and a pagan virtue. But it is pride which makes the bullfight and true enjoyment of killing, which makes the great matador. 30 years later, Tom Lehrer described his experience of a bullfight a bit differently. "There is surely nothing more beautiful in this world," he exclaimed, "than the sight of a lone man facing single-handedly a half-ton of angry pot roast." In the climactic verse of his ballad, he sang, I cheered at the banderos display as they stuck the bull in their own clever way, for I hadn't had so much fun since the day my brother's dog Rover got run over. Rover was killed by a Pontiac, Lehrer added, and it was done with such grace and artistry that the witnesses awarded the driver both ears and the tail. The reaction of young Spaniards today is closer to Lehrer's than to Hemingway's. Their heroes are not matadors, but singers and football players, who become famous without the spiritual and aesthetic pride of killing anything. While bullfighting retains a loyal following in Spain, the crowds are middle-aged and older. Hunting is another pastime that has been in decline. Whether it is from compassion for Bambi or an association with Elmer Fudd, fewer Americans shoot animals for fun. A declining proportion of Americans in the past 3 decades have told the General Society survey that either they or their spouse hunts. Other statistics show that the average age of hunters is steadily creeping upward. It's not just that Americans are spending more time behind video screens and less in the great outdoors. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in the decade between 1996 and 2006, while the number of hunters, days of hunting, and dollars spent on hunting declined by about 10% to 15%, the number of wildlife watchers, days of wildlife watching, and dollars spent on wildlife watching increased by 10% to 20%. People still like to commune with animals. They would just rather look at them than shoot them. It remains to be seen whether the decline will be reversed by the locavore craze, in which young urban professionals have taken up hunting to reduce their food miles and harvest their own free-range, grass-fed, sustainable, humanely slaughtered meat. It's hard to imagine that fishing could ever be considered a humane sport, but anglers are doing their best. Some of them take catch and release a step further and release the catch before it even breaks the surface, because exposure to the air is stressful to a fish. Better still is hookless fly fishing. The angler watches the trout take the fly, feels a little tug on the line, and that's it. One of them describes the experience. I entered the trout's world and got among them in a much more natural way than ever before. I didn't interrupt their feeding rhythms. They took the fly continually, and I still got that little jolt of pleasure you feel when a fish takes your fly. I don't want to harass or harm trout anymore, so now there's a way for me to do that and still keep fishing. And do you recognize this trope? No trees were harmed in the making of this blog post. No hamsters were harmed in the making of this book trailer. No polar bears were harmed in the making of this commercial. No goats were harmed in the writing of this review. No cans of Diet Coke were harmed in the production of this product. No tea partiers were harmed in the protesting of this health care bill. It comes from the trademarked certification of the American Humane Association that no animals were harmed in the making of a motion picture, displayed in the rolling credits after the names of the gaffer and key grip. In response to movies that depicted horses plunging over cliffs by actually filming horses plunging over cliffs, the AHA created its film and television unit to develop guidelines for the treatment of animals in films. As the association explains, today's consumers, increasingly savvy about animal welfare issues, have forged a partnership with American Humane to demand greater responsibility and accountability from entertainment entities that use animal actors, a term they insist on because, they explain, animals are not props. Their 131-page Guidelines for the Safe Use of Animals in Filmed Media, first compiled in 1988, begins with a definition of animal. Any sentient creature, including birds, fish, reptiles, and insects, and leaves no species or contingency unregulated. Here is a page I turned to at random. Water effects. Also see water safety in Chapter 5. 6.2. No animal shall be subjected to extreme forceful rain simulation. Water pressure and the velocity of any fans used to create this effect must be monitored at all times. 6.3. Rubber mats or other non-slip material or surface shall be provided when simulating rain. If effects call for mud, the depth of the mud must be approved by American Humane prior to filming. When necessary, a non-slip surface shall be provided underneath the mud. The AHA boasts that, since the introduction of the guidelines, animal accidents, illnesses, and deaths on the set have sharply declined. They back it up with numbers. The number of films per year designated as unacceptable because of mistreatment of animal actors has declined almost to zero. And if that is not enough to convince you that animal rights have been taken to a new level, consider the events of June 16, 2009, as recounted in a New York Times article entitled, "What's White Has 132 Rooms and Flies." The answer to the riddle is the White House, which had recently become infested with the bugs. During a televised interview, a large fly orbited President Obama's head. When the Secret Service did not wrestle it to the ground, the president took matters into his own hands, using one of them to smack the fly on the back of the other. "I got the sucker," boasted the exterminator-in-chief. The footage became a YouTube sensation, but drew a complaint from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. They noted on their blog, "It can't be said that President Obama wouldn't hurt a fly," and sent over one of their catch-a-bug humane bug catchers in the event of future insect incidents. And finally, we get to meat. If someone were to count up every animal that has lived on Earth in the past 50 years and tally the harmful acts done to them, he or she might argue that no progress has been made in the treatment of animals. The reason is that the animal rights revolution has been partly canceled out by another development, the broiler chicken revolution. The 1928 campaign slogan, "A chicken in every pot," reminds us that chicken was once thought of as a luxury. The market responded by breeding meatier chickens and raising them more efficiently, if less humanely. Factory-farmed chickens have spindly legs, live in cramped cages, breathe fetid air, and are handled roughly when transported and slaughtered. In the 1970s, consumers became convinced that white meat was healthier than red, a trend exploited by the National Pork Board when it came up with the slogan, "The other white meat." And since poultry are small-brained creatures from a different biological class, many people have a vague sense that they are less fully conscious than mammals. The result was a massive increase in the demand for chicken, surpassing in the early 1990s the demand for beef. The unintended consequence was that billions more unhappy lives had to be brought into being and snuffed out to meet the demand, because it takes 200 chickens to provide the same amount of meat as a single cow. Now, factory farming and cruel treatment of poultry and livestock go back centuries, so the baleful trend was not a backsliding of moral sensibilities or an increase in callousness. It was a stealthy creeping up of the numbers, driven by changes in economics and taste, which had gone undetected because a majority of people had always been incurious about the lives of chickens. The same is true, to a lesser extent, of the animals that provide us with the other white meat. But the tide has begun to turn. One sign is the increase in vegetarianism. I'm sure I was not the only dinner host in the 1990s to have had one of my guests announce, as he sat down at the table, "Oh, I forgot to tell you, I don't eat dead animals." Since that era, the question, "Do you have any food restrictions?" has become a part of the etiquette of a dinner invitation, and participants at conference dinners can now tick a box that will replace a plate of rubber chicken with a plate of sodden eggplant. The trend was noted in 2002 when Time magazine ran a cover story entitled, "Should You Be a Vegetarian? Millions of Americans Are Going Meatless." The food industry has responded with a cornucopia of vegetarian and vegan products. The faux meat section of my local supermarket offers soy burgers, garden burgers, seitan burgers, veggie burger meatless patties, tofu pups, not dogs, smart dogs, fakin' bacon, jerky, tofurkey, soy sausage, chorizo, chick patties, meatless buffalo wings, celebration roast, tempeh strips, turkettes, veggie protein slices, veggie scallops, and tuno. The technological and verbal ingenuity is testimony both to the popularity of the new vegetarianism and to the persistence of ancient meat hunger. Those who enjoy a hearty breakfast can serve their veggie breakfast strips with tofu scramblers, perhaps in an omelet with soya kas, soy mage, or veganrella. And for dessert, there's ice bean, rice dream, and tofutti, perhaps garnished with hip whip and a cherry on top. The ultimate replacement for meat would be animal tissue grown in culture, sometimes called meat without feet. The ever-optimistic People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has offered a $1 million prize to the first scientist who brings cultured chicken meat to market. For all the visibility of vegetarianism, pure vegetarians still make up just a few percentage points of the population. It's not easy being green. Vegetarians are surrounded by dead animals and the carnivores who love them, and meat hunger has not been bred out of them. It's not surprising that many fall off the wagon. At any moment, there are 3 times as many lapsed vegetarians as observant ones. Many of those who continue to call themselves vegetarians have convinced themselves that a fish is a vegetable because they partake of fish and seafood and sometimes even chicken. Others parse their dietary restrictions like conservadox Jews in a Chinese restaurant, allowing themselves exemptions for narrowly defined categories or for food eaten outside the home. The demographic sector with the largest proportion of vegetarians is teenage girls, and their principal motive may not be compassion for animals. Vegetarianism among teenage girls is highly correlated with eating disorders. But is vegetarianism at least trending upward? As best we can tell, it is. In the UK, the Vegetarian Society gathers up the results of every opinion poll it can find and presents the data on its information sheets. Over the past 2 decades, vegetarianism has more than tripled from about 2% of the population to about 7%. In the United States, the Vegetarian Resource Group has commissioned polling agencies to ask Americans the more stringent question of whether they eat meat, fish, or fowl, excluding the flexitarians and those with creative Linnaean taxonomies. The numbers are smaller, but the trend is similar, more than tripling in about 15 years. With all the signs of increasing concern with animal welfare, it may be surprising that the percentage of vegetarians, though rising, is still so low. But it really shouldn't be. Being a vegetarian and being concerned with animal welfare are not the same thing. Not only do vegetarians have motives other than animal welfare, health, taste, ecology, religion, driving their mothers crazy, but people who are concerned with animal welfare may wonder whether the symbolic statement of vegetarianism is the best way to reduce animal suffering. They may feel that the hamburgers they altruistically forego are unlikely to register among the noise and the vast national demand for meat, or to lead to the sparing of the lives of any cows. And even if they did, the lives of the remaining cows would be no more pleasant. Changing the practices of the food industry is a collective action dilemma in which individuals are tempted to shirk from private sacrifices that have marginal effects on aggregate welfare. The increase in vegetarianism, though, is a symbolic indicator of a broader concern for animals that can be seen in other forms. People who don't abstain from meat as a matter of principle may still eat less of it. American consumption of meat from mammals has declined since 1980. Restaurants and supermarkets increasingly informed their patrons about what their main course fed on and how freely it ranged while it was still on the hoof or claw. 2 of the major poultry processors in the United States announced in 2010 that they were switching to a more humane method of slaughtering, in which the birds are knocked out by carbon dioxide before being hung by their feet to have their throats slit. The marketers have to walk a fine line. Diners are happy to learn that their entree was humanely treated until its last breath, but they would rather not know the details of exactly how it met its end. and even the most humane technique has an image problem. As one executive said, "I don't want the public to say we gas our chickens." More significantly, a majority of people support legal measures that would solve the collective action problem by approving laws that force farmers and meat packers to treat animals more humanely. In a 2000 poll, 80% of Britons said they would like to see better welfare conditions for Britain's farm animals. Even Americans with their more libertarian temperament are willing to empower the government to enforce such conditions. In a 2003 Gallup poll, a remarkable 96% of Americans said that animals deserve at least some protection from harm and exploitation, and only 3% said that they need no protection, since they are just animals. Though Americans oppose bans on hunting or on the use of animals in medical research and product testing, 62% support strict laws concerning the treatment of farm animals. And when given the opportunity, they translate their opinions into votes. Livestock rights have been written into the laws of Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Maine, Michigan, Ohio, and Oregon. And in 2008, 63% of California voters approved the Prevention of Farm Animal Cruelty Act, which bans veal crates, poultry cages, and sow gestation crates that prevent the animal from moving around. There is a cliche in American politics, as California goes, so goes the country. And perhaps as Europe goes, so goes California. The European Union has elaborate regulations on animal care that start with the recognition that animals are sentient beings. The general aim is to ensure that animals need not endure avoidable pain or suffering, and obliges the owner, keeper of animals, to respect minimum welfare requirements. Not every country has gone so far as Switzerland, which enacted 150 pages of regulations that force dog owners to attend a 4-hour theory course and legislate how pet owners may house, feed, walk, play with, and dispose of their pets. No more flushing live goldfish down the toilet. But even the Swiss balked at a 2010 referendum that would have nationalized a Zurich policy that pays an animal advocate to haul offenders into criminal court, including an angler who boasted to a local newspaper that he took 10 minutes to land a large pike. The angler was acquitted. The pike was eaten. All this may sound like American conservatives' worst nightmare, but they too are willing to allow the government to regulate animal welfare. In the 2003 poll, a majority of Republicans favored passing strict laws on the treatment of farm animals. How far will it go? People often ask me whether I think the moral momentum that carried us from the abolition of slavery and torture to civil rights, women's rights, and gay rights will culminate in the abolition of meat-eating, hunting, and animal experimentation. Will our 22nd century descendants be as horrified that we ate meat as we are that our ancestors kept slaves? Maybe, but maybe not. The analogy between oppressed people and oppressed animals has been rhetorically powerful, and insofar as we are all sentient beings, it has a great deal of intellectual warrant. But the analogy is not exact. African Americans, women, children, and gay people are not broiler chickens, and I doubt that the trajectory of animal rights will be a time-lagged copy of the one for human rights. In his book, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, the psychologist Hal Herzog lays out the many reasons why it's so hard for us to converge on a coherent moral philosophy to govern our dealings with animals. I'll mention a few that have struck me. One impediment is meat hunger and the social pleasures that go with the consumption of meat. Though traditional Hindus, Buddhists, and Jains prove that a meatless society is possible, the 3% market share of vegetarian diets in the United States shows that we are very far from a tipping point. While gathering the data for this chapter, I was excited to stumble upon a 2004 Pew Research poll in which 13% of the respondents were vegetarians. Upon reading the fine print, I discovered that it was a poll of supporters of the presidential candidacy of Howard Dean, the left-wing governor of Vermont. That means that even among the crunchiest granolas in Ben and Jerry land, 87% still eat meat. But the impediments run deeper than meat hunger. Many interactions between humans and animals will always be zero-sum. Animals eat our houses, our crops, and occasionally our children. They make us itch and bleed. They are vectors for diseases that torment and kill us. They kill each other, including endangered species that we would like to keep around. Without their participation in experiments, medicine would be frozen at its current state, and billions of living and unborn people would suffer and die for the sake of mice. An ethical calculus that gave equal weight to any harm suffered by any sentient being, allowing no chauvinism toward our own species, would prevent us from trading off the well-being of animals for an equivalent well-being of humans. For example, shooting a wild dog to save a little girl. To be sure, the interests of humans could be given some extra points by virtue of our zoological peculiarities, such as that our big brains allow us to savor our lives, reflect on our past and future, dread death, and enmesh our well-being with those of others in dense social networks. But the human life taboo, which among other things protects the lives of mentally incompetent people just because they are people, would have to go. Singer himself unflinchingly accepts this implication of a species-blind morality. But it will not take over Western morality any time soon. Ultimately, the move toward animal rights will bump against some of the most perplexing enigmas in the space of human thoughts, a place where moral intuitions start to break down. One is the hard problem of consciousness, namely how sentience arises from neural information processing. Descartes was certainly wrong about mammals, and I am pretty sure he was wrong about fish. But was he wrong about oysters, slugs, termites, earthworms? If we wanted ethical certainty in our cooking, gardening, home repair, and recreation, we would need nothing less than a solution to this philosophical conundrum. Another paradox is that human beings are simultaneously rational, moral agents and organisms that are part of nature, red in tooth and claw. Something in me objects to the image of a hunter shooting a moose. But why am I not upset by the image of a grizzly bear that renders it just as dead? Why don't I think it's a moral imperative to tempt the bear away with all soy, meatless moose patties? Should we arrange for the gradual extinction of carnivorous species, or even genetically engineer them into herbivores? We recoil from these thought experiments because, rightly or wrongly, we assign some degree of ethical weight to what we feel is natural. But if the natural carnivory of other species counts for something, why not the natural carnivory of Homo sapiens, particularly if we deploy our cognitive and moral faculties to minimize the animal's suffering? The imponderables, I suspect, prevent the animal rights movement from duplicating the trajectory of the other rights revolutions exactly. But for now, the location of the finish line is beside the point. There are many opportunities in which enormous suffering by animals can be reduced at a small cost to humans. Given the recent changes in sensibilities, it is certain that the lives of animals will continue to improve. Whence the rights revolutions? When I began my research for this chapter, I knew that the decades of the long peace and the new peace were also decades of progress for racial minorities, women, children, gay people, and animals. But I had no idea that in every case, quantifiable measures of violence, hate crimes and rape, wife beating and child abuse, even the number of motion pictures in which animals were harmed, would all point downward. How can we make sense of all the movements toward nonviolence of the past 50 years? The trends have a few things in common. In each case, they had to swim against powerful currents of human nature. These include the dehumanization and demonization of outgroups, men's sexual rapacity, and their proprietary sentiments toward women. Manifestations of parent-offspring conflict, such as infanticide and corporal punishment, the moralization of sexual disgust and homophobia, and our meat hunger, thrill of the hunt, and boundaries of empathy based on kinship, reciprocity, and charisma. As if biology didn't make things bad enough, The Abrahamic religions ratified some of our worst instincts with laws and beliefs that have encouraged violence for millennia. The demonization of infidels, the ownership of women, the sinfulness of children, the abomination of homosexuality, the dominion over animals and denial to them of souls. Asian cultures have plenty to be ashamed of, too, particularly the mass disowning of daughters that encouraged a Holocaust of baby girls. And then there is the entrenchment of norms, beating wives, smacking children, confining calves, and shocking rats were acceptable because everyone had always treated them as acceptable. Insofar as violence is immoral, the rights revolutions show that a moral way of life often requires a decisive rejection of instinct, culture, religion, and standard practice. In their place is an ethics that is inspired by empathy and reason and stated in the language of rights. We force ourselves into the shoes or paws of other sentient beings and consider their interests, starting with their interest in not being hurt or killed, and we ignore superficialities that may catch our eye, such as race, ethnicity, gender, age, sexual orientation, and, to some extent, species. This conclusion, of course, is the moral vision of the Enlightenment and the strands of humanism and liberalism that have grown out of it. The rights revolutions are liberal revolutions. Each has been associated with liberal movements, and each is currently distributed along a gradient that runs more or less from Western Europe to the blue American states, to the red American states, to the democracies of Latin America and Asia, and then to the more authoritarian countries with Africa and most of the Islamic world pulling up the rear. In every case, the movements have left Western cultures with excesses of propriety and taboo that are deservedly ridiculed as political correctness. But the numbers show that the movements have reduced many causes of death and suffering, and have made the culture increasingly intolerant of violence in any form. To hear the liberal punditry talk, one would think that the United States has been hurtling rightward for more than 40 years, from Nixon to Reagan to Gingrich to the Bushes, and now the angry white men in the Tea Party movement. Yet in every issue touched by the rights revolutions, interracial marriage, the empowerment of women, the tolerance of homosexuality, the punishment of children, and the treatment of animals, the attitudes of conservatives have followed the trajectory of liberals, with the result that today's conservatives are more liberal than yesterday's liberals. As the conservative historian George Nash points out, in practice, if not quite in theory, American conservatism today stands well to the left of where it stood in 1980. Maybe that's why the men are so angry. What caused the rights revolutions? As hard as it was to establish the causes of the Long Peace, New Peace, and 1990s crime decline, it's harder still to pinpoint an exogenous factor that would explain why the rights revolutions bunched up when they did. But we can consider the standard candidates. The post-war years saw an expansion of prosperity, but prosperity has such a diffuse influence on a society that it offers little insight into the revolution's immediate triggers. Money can buy education, police, social science, social services, media penetration, a professional workforce with more women, and better care of children and animals. It's hard to identify which of these made a difference. And even if we could, it would raise the question of why society chose to distribute its surplus among these various goods in such a way as to reduce harm to vulnerable populations. And though I know of no rigorous statistical analysis, I can discern no correlations between the timing of the various upswings in the consideration of rights from the 1960s to the 2000s and the economic booms and recessions of those decades. Democratic government obviously played a role. The rights revolutions took place in democracies, which are constituted as social contracts among individuals designed to reduce violence among them. As such, they contain the seeds of expansion to groups that originally had been overlooked. But the timing remains a puzzle, because democracy is not an entirely exogenous variable. It was the machinery of democracy itself that was at issue during the American Civil Rights Movement, when the political disenfranchisement of blacks was remedied. In the other revolutions, too, new groups were invited or argued their way into full partnership in the social contract. Only then could the government be empowered to police violence or cease its own violence against members of the affected groups. During the rights revolutions, networks of reciprocity and trade had expanded with the shift from an economy based on stuff to one based on information. Women were less enslaved by domestic chores, and institutions sought talent from a wide pool of human capital, rather than just from the local labor supply or old boys' club. As women and members of minority groups were drawn into the wheelings and dealings of government and commerce, they ensured that their interests were factored into their workings. We have seen some evidence for this mechanism. Countries with more women in government and the professions have less domestic violence against women, and people who know gay people personally are less likely to disapprove of homosexuality. But as with democracy, the inclusiveness of institutions is not a completely exogenous process. The hidden hand of an information economy may have made institutions more receptive to women, minorities, and gays, but it still took government muscle in the form of anti-discrimination laws to integrate them fully. And in the case of children and animals, there was no market for reciprocal exchanges at all. The beneficence went in one direction. If I were to put my money on the single most important exogenous cause of the rights revolutions, it would be the technologies that made ideas and people increasingly mobile. The decades of the rights revolutions were the decades of the electronics revolutions. Television, transistor radios, cable, satellite, long-distance telephones, photocopiers, fax machines, the internet, cell phones, text messaging, web video. They were the decades of the interstate highway, high-speed rail, and the jet airplane. They were the decades of the unprecedented growth in higher education and in the endless frontier of scientific research. Less well known is that they were also the decades of an explosion in book publishing. From 1960 to 2000, the annual number of books published in the United States increased almost fivefold. I've mentioned the connection before. The humanitarian revolution came out of the Republic of Letters, and the long peace and new peace were children of the global village. And remember what went wrong in the Islamic world. It may have been a rejection of the printing press and a resistance to the importation of books and the ideas they contain. Why should the spread of ideas and people result in reforms that lower violence? There are several pathways. The most obvious is a debunking of ignorance and superstition. A connected and educated populace, at least in aggregate and over the long run, is bound to be disabused of poisonous beliefs, such as that members of other races and ethnicities are innately avaricious or perfidious, that economic and military misfortunes are caused by the treachery of ethnic minorities, that women don't mind being raped, that children must be beaten to be socialized, that people choose to be homosexual as part of a morally degenerate lifestyle, that animals are incapable of feeling pain. The recent debunking of beliefs that invite or tolerate violence call to mind Voltaire's quip that those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. Another causal pathway is an increase in invitations to adopt the viewpoints of people unlike oneself. The humanitarian revolution had its Clarissa, Pamela, and Julie, its Uncle Tom's Cabin and Oliver Twist, its eyewitness reports of people being broken, burned, or flogged. During the electronic age, these empathy technologies were even more pervasive and engaging. African Americans and gay people appeared as entertainers on variety shows, then as guests on talk shows, and as sympathetic characters on sitcoms and dramas. Their struggles were depicted in real-time footage of fire hoses and police dogs, and in best-selling books and plays like Travels with Charlie, A Raisin in the Sun, and To Kill a Mockingbird. Telegenic feminists made their case on talk shows, and their views came out of the mouths of characters in soap operas and sitcoms. And as we will see in Chapter 9, it is not just the virtual reality experience of seeing the world through another person's eyes that expands empathy and concern. It is also an intellectual agility, literally a kind of intelligence, which encourages one to step outside the parochial constraints of one's birth and station to consider hypothetical worlds and to reflect back on the habits, impulses, and institutions that govern one's beliefs and values. This reflective mindset may be a product of enhanced education, and it may also be a product of electronic media. As Paul Simon marveled, "These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long-distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to us all." There is a third way that a flow of information can fertilize moral growth. Scholars who have puzzled over the trajectory of material progress in different parts of the world, such as the economist Thomas Sowell in his Culture Trilogy and the physiologist Jared Diamond in Guns, Germs, and Steel, have concluded that the key to material success is being situated in a large catchment area of innovations. No one is smart enough to invent anything in isolation that anyone else would want to use. Successful innovators not only stand on the shoulders of giants, they engage in massive intellectual property theft, skimming ideas from a vast watershed of tributaries flowing their way. The civilizations of Europe and Western Asia conquered the world because their migration and shipping routes allowed traders and conquerors to leave behind innovations that had originated anywhere in the vast Eurasian landmass: cereal crops and alphabetic writing from the Middle East, gunpowder and paper from China, domesticated horses from Ukraine, ocean-going navigation from Portugal, and much else. There is a reason that the literal meaning of cosmopolitan is citizen of the world, and the literal meaning of insular is of an island. Societies that are marooned on islands or in impassable highlands tend to be technologically backward, and morally backward, too. We have seen that cultures of honor, whose overriding ethic is tribal loyalty and blood revenge, can survive in mountainous regions long after their lowland neighbors have undergone a civilizing process. What's true of technological progress may also be true of moral progress. Individuals or civilizations that are situated in a vast informational catchment area can compile a moral know-how that is more sustainable and expandable than even the most righteous prophet could devise in isolation. Let me illustrate this point with a potted history of the rights revolutions. In his 1963 essay, Pilgrimage to Nonviolence, Martin Luther King recounted the intellectual threads that he wove into his political philosophy. As a graduate student in theology in the late 1940s and early 1950s, he was, of course, conversant with the Bible and Orthodox theology. But he also read renegade theologians such as Walter Rauschenbusch, who criticized the historical accuracy of the Bible and the dogma that Jesus died for people's sins. King then embarked on a serious study of the social and ethical theories of the great philosophers, from Plato and Aristotle down to Rousseau, Hobbes, Bentham, Mill, and Locke. All of these masters stimulated my thinking, such as it was, and while finding things to question in each of them, I nevertheless learned a great deal from their study. He carefully read and rejected Nietzsche and Marx, inoculating himself against the autocratic and communist ideologies that would be so seductive to other liberation movements. He also rejected the anti-rationalism of the continental theologian Karl Barth, while admiring Reinhold Niebuhr's extraordinary insight into human nature, especially the behavior of nations and social groups. These elements in Niebuhr's thinking helped me to recognize the illusions of a superficial optimism concerning human nature and the dangers of a false idealism. King's thinking was irrevocably changed one day when he traveled to Philadelphia to hear a lecture by Mordecai Johnson, the president of Howard University. Johnson had recently returned from a trip to India and spoke about Mohandas Gandhi, whose influence had recently culminated in national independence. "His message was so profound and electrifying," King wrote, "that I left the meeting and bought a half a dozen books on Gandhi's life and works." King immediately appreciated that Gandhi's theory of nonviolent resistance was not a moralistic affirmation of love, as nonviolence had been in the teachings of Jesus. Instead, it was a set of hard-headed tactics to prevail over an adversary by outwitting him, rather than trying to annihilate him. A taboo on violence, King inferred, prevents a movement from being corrupted by thugs and firebrands who are drawn to adventure and mayhem. It preserves morale and focuses among followers when the movement suffers early defeats. By removing any pretext for a legitimate retaliation by the enemy, it stays on the positive side of the moral ledger in the eyes of third parties, while luring the enemy onto the negative side. For the same reason, it divides the enemy, paring away supporters who find it increasingly uncomfortable to identify themselves with one-sided violence. All the while, it can press its agenda by making a nuisance of itself with sit-ins, strikes, and demonstrations. The tactic obviously won't work with all enemies, but it can work with some. King's historic speech to the March on Washington in 1963 was an ingenious recombination of the intellectual components he had collected during his peripatetic pilgrimage, imagery and language from the Hebrew prophets, the valorization of suffering from Christianity, the ideal of individual rights from the European Enlightenment, cadences and rhetorical tropes from the African-American church, and a strategic plan from an Indian who had been steeped in Jain, Hindu, and British culture. It is not too lazy to say that the rest is history. The moral contrivance assembled by King was thrown back into the idea pool, there to be adapted by the entrepreneurs of the other rights movements. They consciously appropriated its name, its moral rationale, and significantly, many of its tactics. By the standards of history, a striking feature of the late 20th century rights revolutions is how little violence they employed or even provoked. King himself was a martyr of the civil rights movement, as were the handful of victims of segregationist terrorism. But the urban riots that we associate with the 1960s were not a part of the civil rights movement and erupted after most of its milestones were in place. The other revolutions had hardly any violence at all. There was the non-lethal Stonewall riot, some terrorism from the fringes of the animal rights movement, and that's about it. Their entrepreneurs wrote books, gave speeches, held marches, lobbied legislators, and gathered signatures for plebiscites. They had only to nudge a populace that had become receptive to an ethic based on the rights of individuals and were increasingly repelled by violence in any form. Compare this record to that of earlier movements, which ended despotism, slavery, and colonial empires only after bloodbaths that killed people by the hundreds of thousands or millions. From history to psychology. We have come to the end of six chapters that have documented the historical decline of violence. In them, we have seen example after example that locates the first decade of the new millennium at the bottom of a slope representing the use of force over time. For all the violence that remains in the world, we are living in an extraordinary age. Perhaps it is a snapshot in a progression to an even greater peace. Perhaps it is a bottoming out to a new normal, with the easy reductions all plucked and additional ones harder and harder to reach. Perhaps it is a lucky confluence of good fortune that will soon unravel. But regardless of how the trends extrapolate into the future, something remarkable has brought us to the present. One of Martin Luther King's most famous quotations was adapted from an 1852 essay by the abolitionist Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker. "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." A century and a half later, our eyes can see that the arc has bent toward justice in ways that Parker could not have imagined. I do not pretend to understand the moral universe either, nor can I divine it by conscience. But in the next two chapters, let's see how much of it we can understand with science. Chapter 8, Inner Demons. But man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, most ignorant of what he's most assured. His glassy essence, like an angry ape, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as makes the angels weep. William Shakespeare, Measure for Measure. Two aspects of the decline of violence have profound implications for our understanding of human nature. One, the violence. Two, the decline. The last six chapters have shown that human history is a cavalcade of bloodshed. We have seen tribal raiding and feuding that kills a majority of males, the disposal of newborns that kills a majority of females, the staging of torture for vengeance and pleasure, and killings of enough kinds of victims to fill a page of a rhyming dictionary: homicide, democide, genocide, ethnocide, politicide, regicide, infanticide, neonaticide, filicide, siblicide, gynocide, uxoricide, meridicide, and terrorism by suicide. Violence is found throughout the history and prehistory of our species, and shows no sign of having been invented in one place and spread to the others. At the same time, not a single category of violence has been pinned to a fixed rate over the course of history. Whatever causes violence, it is not a perennial urge like hunger, sex, or the need to sleep. The decline of violence thereby allows us to dispatch a dichotomy that has stood in the way of understanding the roots of violence for millennia. Whether humankind is basically bad or basically good, an ape or an angel, a hawk or a dove, the nasty brute of textbook Hobbes or the noble savage of textbook Rousseau. Left to their own devices, humans will not fall into a state of peaceful cooperation, but nor do they have a thirst for blood that must regularly be slaked. There must be at least a grain of truth in conceptions of the human mind that grant it more than one part. Theories like faculty psychology, multiple intelligences, mental organs, modularity, domain specificity, and the metaphor of the mind as a Swiss Army knife. Human nature accommodates motives that impel us to violence, like predation, dominance, and vengeance, but also motives that, under the right circumstances, impel us toward peace, like compassion, fairness, self-control, and reason. This chapter and its successor will explore these motives and the circumstances that engage them. The Dark Side. Before exploring our inner demons, I need to make the case that they exist, because there is a resistance in modern intellectual life to the idea that human nature embraces any motives that incline us toward violence at all. Though the ideas that we evolved from hippie chimps and that primitive people had no concept of violence have been refuted by the facts of anthropology, one still sometimes reads that violence is perpetrated by a few bad apples who do all the damage and that everyone else is peaceful at heart. It is certainly true that the lives of most people in most societies do not end in violence. It is also true that in most hostile encounters, the antagonists, whether humans or other animals, usually back down before either of them can do serious damage to the other. Even in wartime, many soldiers do not fire their weapons and are racked by post-traumatic stress disorder when they do so. Some writers conclude that the vast majority of humans are constitutionally averse to violence, and that the high body counts are merely signs of how much harm a few psychopaths can do. So let me begin by convincing you that most of us, including you, dear listener, are wired for violence, even if in all likelihood we will never have an occasion to use it. We can begin with our younger selves. The psychologist Richard Tremblay has measured rates of violence over the course of the lifespan and shown that the most violent stage of life is not adolescence or even young adulthood, but the aptly named terrible twos. A typical toddler, at least, sometimes kicks, bites, hits, and gets into fights, and the rate of physical aggression then goes steadily down over the course of childhood. Tremblay remarks, Babies do not kill each other because we do not give them access to knives and guns. The question we've been trying to answer for the past 30 years is how do children learn to aggress? But that's the wrong question. The right question is how do they learn not to aggress?